Welcome to YHS on Monster Island's countdown of the top 10 Ultra Q episodes. But before we start our list, please be sure to check out YHS on Monster Island on YouTube or any major podcast platform. Hosts Jacob Walsh and Jay Key are covering all parts of the kaiju landscape. From films to fandom, television to toys, it's always a good time with YHS on Monster Island, a member of the Yes Have Some Media Network. Before there was the pop culture phenomenon of Ultraman, Tsuburaya Productions tested the tokusatsu on television waters with Ultra Q, a show more akin to The Twilight Zone or Outer Limits than a weekly monster melee. But executives at the Tokyo Broadcasting System felt the momentum from the kaiju genre and encouraged more giant monsters to be added to the show. Eventually, with the addition of more daikaiju, the series would become the most expensive to be produced in Japan at that time. But it was money well spent. The immediate and immense popularity of Ultra Q, coupled with a flurry of kaiju eiga from numerous studios released around the same time, created what would be popularized as the kaiju boom. Ultra Q still managed to showcase stories that were without the huge city-crushing gargantuas and relied on plots dealing with mysterious occurrences, supernatural speculation, and near-future scenarios heavy on science fiction. The connective tissue of Ultra Q extended to both the past and future of the tokusatsu genre, and from the human actors to the rubber-suited beasts that amaze and entertain Japanese children in 1966. The cast was led by veteran Toho star Kenji Sahara as Jun Manjume, and featured numerous roles and cameos from other legendary Godzilla film actors like Yoshifumi Tajima, Akihiko Harada, Hiroshi Koizumi, Yoshio Tsuchiya, Jun Tazaki, Akiko Wakabayashi, Susumu Fujita, Akira Kubo, and Hideo Amamoto. But the presence of familiar faces extended to the monsters as well, though slightly altered, of course. Manda became Karyu, Maguma became Todora, Baragon became Pagos, King Kong, Goro, a Rodan prop for Litra and Larugius, and most famously, Godzilla was creatively morphed into Gomez. Though the connection with the past was strong, Ultra Q gave tokusatsu fans a sneak peek at its future. The future Fujin Ultraman, Hiroko Sakurai, was introduced as one of the leads, Yuriko, and in cameo roles, Akiji Kobayashi, Masanari Nihei, Ben Furuya, and Tsusumu Kurobe all representing that follow-up show
that would change tokusatsu forever.
But it wasn't just Ultraman 66. Return of Ultraman's Nobuo Sukumoto and Mirror Man's Kentaro Kudo also made appearances. Similarly, on the kaiju front, Ultra Q's Kimer and Ragon would return in Ultraman in giant form. A modified Pegila would become Chandlar, Cicada Man's head would find new life as part of Alien Baltan, a human-sized Kimer would become Alien Zeton, and Peter would become the basis for Gesser. And lastly, Garamon would become the fan-favorite kaiju, Pigmon. Ultra Q may not have maintained the same level of fame as the Henshin hero-centric shows that it helped spawn. The impact on transitioning a largely film-focused genre into one perfectly made for the small screen cannot be overstated. Though its 28-episode run was only 6 months long and was quickly eclipsed by Ultraman's debut just 2 weeks later, it serves as the proverbial linchpin to two eras of tokusatsu media. And included in those 28 are some entries that will forever withstand the test of time. So let's buy a ticket on Hoshikawa Air Service, open up today's edition of the Daily News, and let's get debating our list of the top 10 Ultra Q episodes. What's cooler than a high-speed bullet train? Maybe one with an artificial lifeform that had just been brought to life from a dormant state by a camera flash? The last episode to actually be filmed, though airing 10th in the series, the Underground Super Express Goes West is a memorable entrant for many reasons. Most notably, it gave us tokusatsu fans the ape-like lifeform M1, and it also gave us the price-gouging miscreant Weasel, who was a little chauvinistic. The story centers around the launch of the Onazuma, the world's fastest super express, and not only Weasel, but Ipe trying to find a way to sneak on board. And general silliness ensues. Two kids in a trench coat pretending to be an adult. The old briefcase switcheroo, with Ipe grabbing one containing the experimental lifeform M1 in a high-pressure cylinder. The usual stuff. A flash from a photographer starts the hyper-evolution of M1 just in time to be locked into a cabin with Weasel. M1 utterly destroys the controls and then proceeds to ride the train, now exceeding 600 miles per hour. The passengers are detached from the conductor's cabin, but poor Weasel is still stuck in there with M1. What happens next is what makes this episode so great, and something that Ultra Q does on more than one occasion. The ending shows the train flying off into space with Weasel still inside. As they orbit the planet, Weasel opens the hatch, not suffocating or freezing to death, and M1 speaks, "I am Seagull, I am Seagull." Did they survive? Did they die? Did they enter an alternate dimension? The Underground Super Express Goes West is zany for sure. However, when you get comfortable laughing alongside our characters, it hits you with a thought-provoking moment that forces the viewer to interpret its meaning. But one thing that needs no interpretation is that this episode is a worthy entry into our top 10. The ninth entry in our list is quite possibly one of the most polarizing episodes in Ultra Q, Grow Up Little Turtle. It's bizarre, confusing, really funny, and is the first Ultra Q episode to really embrace a surrealist approach to storytelling. The episode features a little boy, Taro, who is fascinated with his turtle, much to the chagrin of his teacher, and believes if his pet reaches a length of 99 centimeters, he will fly Taro to the Dragon Palace. Sounds like a reasonable assumption, but his delusions invite the ridicule and mocking of his peers and instructor, who confiscates Taro's shelled sidekick. Taro is sent to the roof, and the turtle is, hung on a string? On the roof, Taro witnesses a robbery, of course he does, but shockingly no one believes his account. You know, on account of thinking his turtle was going to carry him off into the sky to a hidden castle? The turtle gets away from Taro and finds his way into the bag of one of the robbers, who just happens to be Masanari Nihei, the future Ide in Ultraman. Taro tries to recover his pet from the robbers, but mostly just yells a lot. He also manages to simply take a machine gun away from the criminals, almost shoots them, then himself, and chases them in a sewer. We learn that this trip to the Dragon Palace will also include meeting Princess Otohime, his promotion to CEO, and his acquisition of 800 pistols and a bazooka. Yikes, Taro. And inexplicably, the turtle does grow to 99 centimeters, develops the ability to walk through walls, why the hell not, and eventually they set off for the Dragon Palace. Lucky for Taro, the turtle is equipped with blinkers, a speedometer, and can go Mach 3. Taro can also breathe fine underwater for long periods of time. Out of nowhere, he's on a cloud, or maybe still underwater with this creepy little girl on a swing, aka the Dragon Palace and Princess Otohime. And this is where it gets weird, or weirder. The little girl makes some ice cream. Taro wants to nuke the entire world because he does. He gets the cartoon explosion treatment for that. There's a chase with Taro on his turtle and the creepy princess on a missile, which magically becomes Manda? He is sent back to the classroom, but is turned into a grandpa. Yeah, sure, why not? After he turns back to normal, he's the only one without a turtle, and is tortured by the taunts of the princess. Much has been made of the misfire on the moral of the story, or lack of one altogether, because Taro is presented and treated as a liar. But really, he's just a kid with a vivid imagination. So did he actually learn anything? He told the truth at the end, and no one believed him. Oh yeah, and where'd the turtle go? This episode is not everyone's cup of tea, but its unique imagery and unorthodox narrative make it one of the most memorable in the Ultra series. And it's number 9 on our top 10 list. Ultra Q's ability to take off-the-wall concepts for life forms and portray them as not just credible, but powerful threats is one of the most enduring legacies of the series. And a perfect example of that is from episode 11, Balunga. One of the more moody vibes in the first half of the series, the story is a not-so-subtle attack on humanity's increasing energy consumption. Enter Balunga, an organism with a balloon-like composition that absorbs all forms of energy, leading to massive blackouts across Japan. Yes, it's this giant balloon, not a menacing alien or behemoth kaiju, that quickly becomes, possibly, the greatest threat to humanity's survival. The episode clearly and concisely hammers home its main theme and is supported by intriguing storylines from the human characters, namely the interaction with the reclusive scientist with ties to the space creature and the sense of urgency when Ipe requires life-saving surgery during the Balunga-induced power outage. All in all, it's a fast-paced entry into the series that really has the viewer concerned for not just our main characters like Ipe, but for the entire planet. And all it took was a giant balloon blob with tentacles that floats. And because of that, Balunga floats to number 8 on our list. The third episode in, and we have our first real alien threat. And that rampaging brute is one of the most beloved and memorable of the series, Nomagon. And the episode with this giant slug monster is equally as memorable, The Gift from Space. Thematically, there is little nuance to what this entry is trying to convey. Space exploration by humans is not an endeavor without risk. And apparently some Martians didn't take too kindly to Earthers sending out their probes and rockets and whatnot in the name of discovery. The Martians simply sent it back to us, but with a couple of surprises packaged in little golden spheres. What makes the episode even more powerful is that the macro story, humanity's ignorance of not considering possible consequences to their exploration efforts, is supported by a micro story highlighting the societal issues plaguing the human race, in this instance, crime and greed. The strategically meandering pace of the episode gives the viewer time for that singular theme to set in, aided by some haunting visuals and an on-point score. Like so many other Ultra Q episodes, the final moments leave the viewer with more questions than answers. And in the case of The Gift from Space, it emphasizes the entry's bleak message with another monster bound to pick up where the other left off. That commitment and expert execution of the episode's primary theme, coupled with a stalk-eyed slug that would become a fan favorite, help give the gift of the seventh spot to The Gift from Space. The sixth episode on our list injects the series with some classic horror vibes, reminiscent of a Universal Classic Monsters film from the 40s or 50s. And the visuals achieved in this entry, be it the eerie lighting or the lumbering zombie-like attacks of Ragon, are paramount to why it became a memorable piece of Ultra lore. But despite the tones conjured up around the monster's presence, it's ultimately a natural disaster plot with looming tectonic shifts that will send the small island to the bottom of the ocean. It's a reminder of nature's power. No matter the advancements of humanity, the Earth still has the power to sink an island, even Japan in the future. But also, it's a reminder of the planet's vastness, as those very same tectonic shifts allow the race of Ragon to the surface. However, undersea humanoid Ragon does not simply stop with an iconic monster, timeless horror elements, and a theme of how puny we really are compared to the power of Earth. No. It also manages to endear Ragon to the viewers, despite the spooky rampage, as it's simply looking for its stolen baby. And the final scene of the villagers realizing this and returning the child to its parent moments before the island is completely destroyed is one of the more powerful in the series. For these reasons, this episode lands in our top 10. The 15th episode in the series, and number 5 on our list, Baron Spider, has no business being on any top 10 list. We have characters we've never seen before that are forced upon the viewer. There isn't a strong plot to speak of, and it's full of every Halloween and spooky cliche that one can think of. But yet, somehow, Ultra Q not only pulls it off, it turns it into one of the best episodes in the series. June, Yuri, and Ipe are joined by 3 friends, one being Princess Salno herself, famed Bond girl Akiko Wakabayashi. And after some misfortune, they're forced to spend the night in a creepy old mansion. Though the viewer is subjected to elements that are present in most haunted house narratives, swamps, cobwebs, and the like, what holds it all together is the backstory of the former mansion owner, an eccentric aristocrat that loved spiders until his daughter was bitten by one, turning her into a demonic arachnid. The Baron, too, upon his death, joined her as an 8-legged monster. The remainder of the show is essentially the 6 friends trying to escape the mansion before becoming spider food. The spiders themselves are nothing more than clumsy puppets, but they are used sparingly and sporadically, and the anticipation of when they will pop up next to harass our protagonists adds a palpable layer of tension to the proceedings. It's a moody, shadowy, and foreboding episode that is engaging and entertaining. And it's number 5 on our list. Similar to Grow Up Little Turtle, Canagon's Cocoon is a polarizing entry into the series because of how far it deviates from anything resembling, well, anything. The surreal story gives us Canagon, one of the genre's most iconic monsters, so that's a checkmark on the positive side of the ledger. But unlike its spiritual cousin, the theme is delivered with little uncertainty. Kids, don't be greedy. Also, in yet another one of Ultra Q's bold moves that they somehow pull off, the main cast, June, Yuri, and Ipe, aren't even in this episode. It's centered around a young boy named Kanyo and his uncontrollable love of money. But his parents remind him that a greedy child turns into a Kanagon, and with the help of a magical cocoon that he commandeered from another kid at a local junkyard marketplace, for lack of a better term, Kanyo does exactly that. Poof! He's a Kanagon. Another unique twist, Kanagons must continually consume money, monitored by his counter on the chest. Otherwise, he'll starve to death. Kanyo's fellow rascals keep him alive for a bit before realizing that he's just too damn expensive, and they give up. Others decide to turn to God. Yes, God. Why not? But God in Ultra Q is a crazy old witch doctor lady living in a shanty, and she offers the logical solution. Turn Daddy Walrus upside down, and Kanyo will turn back into a boy. Did we mention that the big bad in this episode is a guy named Daddy Walrus that hates kids and likes to chase them with heavy construction vehicles? Oh yeah, and his sidekick is Masanari Nihe, who is also in Grow Up Little Turtle. Eventually, despite a lot of whining and friends' plans to sell him back to the circus, he manages to flip over Daddy Walrus and, logically, shoots into the sky with a jetpack to become a kid again. But that's not all. Kanyo returns home, and it's revealed that his parents are now Kanagons. On the surface, this is a madcap, wacky story that is possibly the most engaging entry in the entire series. It gives us a clear moral, but there is some ambiguity on whether Kanyo actually became less greedy, unless an upside-down Daddy Walrus is a metaphor for being charitable that I'm not aware of. But there were real stakes in the plot. Kanyo's consistent struggle and survival as Kanagon, and how many of his friends gave up or were so annoyed by his constant whines that it almost cost him his life. And though he escaped life as a coin-eating monster, his parents are just beginning that journey, creating a never-ending cycle of greed. It does make you think, but what we don't have to think about is where Kanagon's cocoon winds up on our top 10 list as it cashes in at number 4. Now we are in our final 3, and kicking it off is an all-timer when it comes to memorable tokusatsu television episodes, the 14th in the series, Tokyo Ice Age. This marks the second appearance of the monster Pegila, whom first appeared in episode 5, Pegila is Here. This vastly superior installment does reference the events of the first episode. In fact, Pegila is driven away from the South Pole, his former home, due to drilling, and is heading to the North Pole with a pit stop in Tokyo to destroy some buildings and such. In addition, the substance that drove Pegila away previously, Pegamin H, is needed again, and June and Yoshifumi Tajima's Mr. Seki are trying to secure the substance. But of course, they're roadblocked by government approvals and red tape. The action with Pegila is excellent. The commentary on environmental awareness and Japanese bureaucracy are poignant. But the one that really drives home this episode as one of the all-time best is that of a young boy Haruo befriended by Yuri and the drunken haggard bank robber holding Jun and Ipe hostage. The connection between the boy and the man is fairly obvious, but that doesn't make the story any less intriguing. The father, trying to right a lifetime of wrongs, sacrifices himself to defeat Pegila, saving his son and Tokyo. And it delivers that emotional gut punch, as intended, and caps off one of the strongest 30 minutes of Ultra Q. Not only does Ultra Q not need kaiju or seijin or anything beastly in nature, it sometimes excels without them. The perfect example of that is the 17th episode in the series, The 1-8 Project, which examines the near-future possibility of human population growth to the point that it risks the health of the entire planet. After being trampled in a mad rush at the train station, Yuri is intrigued by a new experiment called the 1-8 Project. After accidentally enlisting, she is reduced to 1/8 her normal size, as are many other Japanese citizens, in an effort to reduce the urban population density. Names are removed in this new society, instead only being referred to as numbers. However, it's discovered that she doesn't have the proper paperwork and is thrown in jail. The role of the giant monsters in this episode are played by June and Ipe, normal-sized humans, as they discover the miniature city and try and free Yuri. It's a nice twist on the kaiju genre. Everything about this episode delivers. It's powerful and imaginative, serious and whimsical, and Hiroko Sakurai delivers her best performance of the series. The practical, oversized props are extremely well done and believable, allowing the episode to excel at the scaling issues that typically present themselves when extreme miniaturization is a critical plot element. When Yuriko awakes, we realize that it was just a dream during her unconscious state after being trampled in the crowded train station. But it's no dream that this unique episode, is one of the top in the series, and it's number 2 on our list. Before we get to what we feel is the best Ultra Q episode, we have to call out a few that just barely missed out on our list. But though they didn't make ours, there's a good chance that they made yours, because they delivered on many of the elements that make a strong episode. Some gave us notable monsters like the very first Ultra Q episode to air, Defeat Gomez, or they effectively mashed up genres like the Kaiju Caper, The Idol of Goga, or the eerie J-horror entry, Devil Child. One thing that Ultra Q did really well was deliver somewhat offbeat or surreal stories in a digestible and entertaining manner. Beyond the titles in the list already, Blazing Victory and the series finale Open Up did just that and managed to intertwine real human issues into the plot. Lastly, before we unveil our number one, what's yours? Now, the episode that is the very best of Ultra Q and number one on our top 10 list. In the entire Ultra series, the moniker of favorite kaiju has to go to that of Garamon Pigmon. And though this is technically his second appearance, as he was tapped to be a returning monster much like Pagila, this is his first true masterpiece. It's wall-to-wall entertainment that gave us not only the return of Garamon, rather Garamons, but kaiju acting royalty in Akihiko Harada. And it also gave us the first sentient alien shown on screen, Human Cicada, which would go on to be the basis for the design of Alien Baltan. The plot centers around a race to secure a fragment of the Garadama, which was stolen by the aliens, and it's stirring, and it's tense, and it's full of narrative velocity. It makes a viewer wonder if the first Garamon episode in the series, which was notably more plotting, was merely a setup for Garamon Strikes Back. And if so, it worked. The episode is primarily focused on the macro stakes, world destruction by the aliens, but we don't lose our crew in the scope, as they are front and center throughout. The ending scene where the alien is incinerated by his own people for failing in his mission is brutal and savage, adding a dread-inducing postscript to the invaders. At the end of the day, the iconic Garamon, placed in a fast-paced, thrilling plot, is a combination that is nearly impossible to top. And in our opinion, no other Ultra Q entry did. Garamon Strikes Back is our number one Ultra Q episode. That's our list. Be sure and leave yours in the comments. We are here to start debates, not to end them. And be sure and check out YHS on Monster Island. Until next time, adios.